This is a continuation of the journey through Isaiah. Couldn't possibly tell you what class number it was, maybe 22, 23, maybe more than that. But we're in chapter 21. Now, what's going on in this section? When I say this section, I'm talking about 13 through 23. What, how would you characterize this section?
Virgins.
Sure. Okay. Burdens.
Dealing with the nations.
Dealing with the burden on the nation, dealing with the nations. Okay. What else? Let's try to get a historic perspective. We always want to kind of get the historic overlay, historic perspective, what's going on in the lives of the people who received the message. How important is that? First of all, how important is it for us to know what was going on in the lives of the people who received any message?
Well, if we don't, then we don't know what the
Context, they're
no no
getting
no no the
consequences.
yeah what why they're even why this is even being said.
Yeah.
Context.
Like one old buddy said, context is everything. You want to understand the message of Isaiah, you need to understand the circumstances that his people were living in and through. Go all the way back to chapter 8. What was about to flood and be flooded? What was the flood and what was the be flooded?
Yeah.
Assyria was the flood, wasn't it? And the Assyrian invasion, and what was being flooded?
The tribes.
The entire,
I guess the Arab
yeah,
region.
the entire Mediterranean, Eastern Mediterranean coast, the entire Mediterranean coast was being overrun, including Egypt. Now, the Assyrian invasion was augmented by, Assyrian invasion would be flood part one, and the Babylonian invasion would be flood part two. It was just an extension and a completion, a continuation, as it were. So in chapter 8, it's the Babylonian that was flooding and plunging the entire area into darkness. Yeah, 8:22. I think it's 22. The last three verses of chapter 8 talked about if they don't talk like we need to listen to God, it's because they have, verse 20, they have no dog. And then in verse 22, they will be driven away into darkness. So with the Babylonian invasion, that area was being driven into or plunged into darkness. What did we learn in chapter 10 regarding the Assyrian as a tool in God's hand? What did we learn
Their
there?
axe
It was the axe in God's hand to do what?
to take down the
Cut
trees.
down the forest that was called Israel. What would happen to the axe after Israel had been duly punished?
It would
It
be
would be
taken,
punished,
but
right?
yeah.
Okay. Now, scattered around that, chapter 9, chapter 11, have promises of the son that would be given and the branch of Jesse that would grow up and judge righteously. So we have a promise on either side of that, of the coming order of things under God's Messiah. But that's not yet. We're dealing with the Assyrian Babylonian invasion at this time. So chapters 13 and 14, then chapter 10 is the cutting down of Israel by Assyria, and then the punishing of Assyria, and he doesn't say by whom, but you know by whom. Babylon. Okay. So in chapter 13 and 14, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's talking about Babylon, but it's also talking about the downfall of the Assyrian, and it introduces the Medo-Persians. That's in 13 and 14. So we've got this picture. I hope we painted a reasonable picture in your heads, that we've got this picture of the entire Mediterranean coast, including Egypt. Chapter 19 is the invasion into Egypt, including Egypt and off into the Arabian desert, which we'll pick up tonight. We've got this invasion. And so then in 15 and 16 and 17 and 18 and 19 and 20 and 21 and 22 and 23 is God's advice to the nations that are being impacted by the invasion. Now, there's going to be a coming end to it. That's what we learned in chapter 10. We also learned it in the fall of the Medo-Persians. I know the fall of Babylon to the Medo-Persians. We learned that in chapter 14. That these empires are not going to last forever, but there would be a Messiah who would come, and he would establish a kingdom that would continually increase. That's in chapter 9, right? So we have this message to all the surrounding nations. Can you sum it up for me in a simple thought?
Well, I think of the statue in Daniel.
Okay.
That.
The metal man image of Daniel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the gold, the silver.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the nations coming down to Rome. And during the time that Rome's in charge, that's when Jesus will come.
Yeah.
And the church will start.
But what about the nations as they're facing this onslaught? What was the
judgment?
Don't. Don't look for security here.
Zion.
Take your lamb to Zion. Your security will not be in any of the things that those nations were noted for, whether it be gross national product, whether it be the power of their military, whether it be the wisdom of their counselors, whether it be the natural defenses. None of those things where the security of a nation lies. Go to Zion. Take your tribute lamb to Zion. Okay, so that's kind of the overriding picture of these 11 chapters. Okay?
You know, Rod, I
yeah,
think
go ahead.
What a lot of people miss is that God didn't write most of these nations off.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted them. I want you just as much as I want Israel.
You know, that's such a brilliant point. I look for the term remnant or survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I find it applied to the remnant of God's people.
Mm-hmm.
But over in Zechariah 9, about verse 7, he says the Philistines will be a remnant. But your thought is really spectacular. God is asking all these nations, come to me. They come to Zion. Bring your tribute to me. These other gods can't help you, but I can. That's a great point. Okay, now that's a kind of a broad overview of the section that we're dealing with. I want to go back and pick up some thoughts from where we left. We got halfway through chapter 21 last week. We got down through verse 10. Which was a prophecy, oracle against Babylon. Notice in verse 2, go up Elam, lay siege, Media. Who was it that was responsible for the downfall of Babylon?
The
Medo-Persians, the Elam and Media. And so it's a call for them to come take Babylon down. Verse 4, my mind reels with... over and horror overwhelms me just thinking about the demise of Babylon. Look at verse 7. Here's a watchman that has been stationed in verse 6. When he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, a train of donkey, a train of camels, let him pay close attention, very close attention. When the watchman sees this supposed caravan coming, he's supposed to be very attentive. The lookout called, verse 8, O Yahweh, I stand continually by day on the watchtower. I'm there, I'm watching, right? Now behold, here comes a troop of riders. What's the next phrase?
Horsemen in pairs.
Compare that to verse 7, when the rider, when he sees riders, horsemen in pairs. I'm seeing it. See? 7 is fulfilled in 9. When you see it, okay, now I see it. And he answered, fallen, fallen is Babylon. Babylon's going down. And all the images of her gods are shattered on the ground. Now, verse 10, I don't think is talking about the prophet lamenting the fall of Babylon. I think it's the prophet lamenting what Babylon had done to God's people. Oh, my threshed and my afflicted of the threshing floor. What I have heard from Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, I make known to you. See, Babylon hasn't happened yet. As Isaiah is writing this, Babylon is at least 100 years away, and maybe more. And the fall of Babylon is 70 years after that. And here Isaiah is seeing what's going to come to God's people, and he groans over it. What I have heard from Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, I make known to you. Now, what are you going to do with the information you get? That's the real question, isn't it? What are you going to do when you hear from God? When you read something and it says, this is the way it is, or this is what's going to happen, what are you going to do with that?
Tell the people.
Everybody has a choice, either to respond to it or to ignore it. And like Linda says, spread it and make sure everybody has a chance to make that choice. We're going to see a little bit of that when we get into chapter 22 in a minute. But I look at verse 10 as the remnant of Israel. My afflicted of the threshing floor. What happens on a threshing floor?
Separation.
Separation. That's the word I was looking for. The wheat, the kernels, the keepable part from the throwaway part. That's the way I like to say it. And generally speaking, which is in more a greater abundance, the keepable part or the throwaway part?
Throwaway.
The throwaway part. And so always, I think one of the prophets said, 1 out of 10. He wasn't being literal, he was representative. Just got a small one prophet says, like a shepherd snatches a sheep from the lion, he might get a couple of hooves or a piece of an ear, just a remnant. That is just the prophetic way of saying, I'm not going to have very many people of all my people because most of my people aren't going to listen. Anyway. Isaiah says, I make known to you. I make known to you. You might just connect with Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33, where God calls Ezekiel a watchman. And he says, "What when I give you a message of danger, you better share it. If you don't share it, the people are going to die in their sin because they're sinners, but
Be responsible.
you'll be. You will be held to account. But if you do tell them and they don't change, they'll die in your sin, but you've delivered yourself. So he says, I make known to you. Now, the oracle concerning Edom, new material. Now, I just want to pick up some new thoughts here. Well, cover some new ground. Well, again, remind me, what does the word oracle mean? It's not a racing yacht, is it? Can you tell that I like to watch the America's Cup races? It's a bird. Here's what I'm laying on you. When God speaks, he's laying it on us, right? One keeps calling to me from Seir. What is Seir? Pardon? It's the mountain. The mountain. The mountain of Israel would be Zion. to mountain of Edom would be Seir. Okay, so an identifiable spot in Edom. Watchman, how far gone is the night? Watchman, how far gone is the night? The watchman says, the morning comes, but also night. If you would inquire, inquire. Come back again. That's the whole thing about Edom. What do you make of that? How far gone is the night? Kind of just focus on that. What is the night? Well, you know,
darkness.
You got an 8, 12, 10, 12 hour period of time of darkness. Is that what he's talking about?
It'd be the destruction.
Yeah.
Well,
short
you
period
go
of
all the way
time.
Back to chapter. Pardon, Michael?
A short period of time.
Nah, I think we're looking in the wrong direction. Okay. You go back to chapter 8. If you got this invasion of Assyria and you either hunker down, trust in God, or you don't. And if you don't, you're plunged into darkness. They have no dawn. See, that's the night. This coming national invasion. That's the night. That's the night. Okay. How far gone is it? Well, if you're under the Assyrian attack, the Assyrian occupation, you say, how far gone is the night? What are you asking?
How long is it going to last?
Yeah. I mean,
when's it ending?
Imagine what the people in Gaza were saying. I mean, just recently, as they were being held captive by Hamas. When is this going to be over? Right? When's this going to be over? How far gone is the night? And the watchman said, morning comes. What do you suppose the morning was? Morning comes, but also night.
It was light at the end of the tunnel,
but then another tunnel. Okay? So what happens when the Assyrian is conquered?
Bring the Babylon stone.
Well, no. It's over. But
false sense of security.
And isn't that the point he's getting to? When this one conquering empire falls, that's not the end of your night.
Yeah.
See? So come back. If you want to inquire, come back again. Yeah, you're going to ask the same question again. I think what he's saying is the fall of this, and it reminded me a lot of what we had in chapter 14, the vision to Philistia. Let me get here and read it again. In 1429, in the year that King Ahaz, 28, in King the King year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. Don't rejoice, Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. From the serpent's root, a viper will come out. And we made the same point there. You get a sense of sigh of relief when the tyrant falls, only to be replaced by a subsequent tyrant. You're not going to have the kind of security when the tyrant falls. Wouldn't it have been great historically if Pol Pot were the last tyrant that ever occupied the face of this earth? But we know he wasn't.
We had Saddam.
And we had Hitler. And was Hitler before or after Pol Pot?
Before.
Hitler was before.
Okay. We had Saddam. We had, what's the guy in Libya?
More and more I'm Daffy.
Gaddafi.
Yeah, more and more I'm Daffy. Okay, and so you think that's what we're getting at here. He says, morning comes, and I go back to chapter 8, verse 20 through 22. If they won't look to God for guidance, it's because they don't have any dawn, and they'll be plunged, cursing God and their king, into darkness. But then in chapter 9, I have it written down here, at 9 verse 2, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Of course, that's quoted in Matthew 4, 15 and 16, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. That was the fulfillment. The dawn that didn't go back into night. The morning comes, but also night. The dawn that doesn't go back into night came when Jesus started preaching. Which gives us what we've been saying. You want true security, come to Zion. All right. Any thoughts on that? That was Edom. Now we have the oracle concerning Arabia.
Can you just go over the, if you would inquire, come back again?
I think to me that represents that there are going to be waves of respite throughout history.
Okay.
But there's going to be, I mean, oh, great. Medo-Persia's gone. Medo-Persia. Oh, great. Medo-Persia's gone. Alexander. Oh, great. Alexander and his guys are gone. Rome. So I think that's the idea. Ask, what's it like now? What's world history like now?
Right.
And that's what how I take it.
Okay.
Michael?
Would it also be Edom, was a different land, but God trying to call to show forth that what he is bringing as judgment, that if it comes again to inquire of him, not their idols or their false teachers or
Well, it could be, but the inquiry seems to be, watchman, how far gone is the night? And the watchman says, it's coming back. Come back and inquire again. This is the watchman asking people to inquire of him what it looks like out there on the world stage. I don't think it's referencing, like you say, other places do, but I don't think here it's referencing ask God, not the idols, because you're asking the watchman, watchman, how far gone is the night? Morning comes, but also night. So that's why I take it that way. Go ahead. All right. The oracle concerning Arabia. Where is Arabia?
East of Israel.
East of Israel, the great sandy desert. One of my favorite movies.
Lawrence Boyd.
No. It's what was that horse's name?
Oh, Fidalgo.
Hidalgo.
Hello.
Hidalgo. Where they have this horse race across the great sandy ocean. And this American rider ends up winning it. It's a great movie. Anyway, but it's a great sandy waste. The oracle about Arabia. In the thickets of Arabia, you must spend the night, O caravans of Dedanites. Bring water for the thirsty, O inhabitants of the land of Tema. Meet the fugitive with bread, for they have fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, and from the bent bow, and from the press of battle. What do you have there? What's the picture you get? In verse 14, you got thirsty fugitives. In verse 15, you got them fleeing from the battles. So is this the Arabians, the Dedanites? Dedan was a city, and Tema was a city out there in the wilderness, in Kedar as well. These were cities out in the Arabian wilderness or sandy waste. Is it them that are fleeing, or are there fugitives from other places fleeing to them? And you see, Arabia, the Arabians are to bring water and to meet the fugitives with bread. So I don't think this is the Arabians fleeing from the invasion, but the Arabians counseled to provide for those who are fleeing from the invasion, that they would be scattered even out into the sandy waste. For thus Yahweh said to me, in a year, as a hired man would count it, all the splendor of Kedar will terminate, and the remainder of the number of bowmen, the mighty men of the sons of Kedar, will be few. For Yahweh, God of Israel, has spoken. Now that piece confuses me, because that might mean then that the residents of Kedar are the ones that are fleeing, because they are the ones that are being brought down, aren't they? The splendor of Kedar will terminate. The remainder of their number of the bowmen, the mighty men of Kedar, will be few, those left after the battle. So I'm not quite sure, what he's referencing here, and I'm open to suggestion, but this one thing that I do have is that these are cities, and some cities like Jerusalem, protected by a wall. We've seen pictures of cities in England and other places protected by not only a wall but a moat. These cities, Kedar, Teman, you've heard of the Temanite. One of Job's three friends was from Teman, Tema. These are protected by a massive desert waste that getting to them, and there's very little profit along the way as you would march against it. But even that was not a full security, because Kedar would be reduced to almost rubble. So what are your thoughts? Scott, you look like you're about ready to say something.
Yeah, it could be that people fled there and the army chased them
Yeah.
and they just got caught up in the
Yeah, and
collateral damage.
that makes the same point though, doesn't it? Even out here where you've got this wide open sandy space, is not a protection. You are still vulnerable to the, well, what does it say? For Yahweh, God of Israel, has spoken. Where can you hide that God can't find you? Remember Jonah? Even at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, God could hear his prayer, knew exactly where he was. There's nowhere you can go that you can hide from God, and there's no place on earth that you're safe except Zion. And I
Hey,
think that's the
Ron.
point. Yes, Pam.
In verse 13, it says, "O caravans of Dedanites, who are Dedanites?"
That's one of the cities. Dedan would be one of the cities in the Arabian desert.
Oh.
Dedan and Tema and Kedar would be cities out there. Few and far between.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, chapter 22 now. The Oracle Concerning the Valley of Vision. Interesting to me that all these other oracles were focused on a titular name of here, Arabia or Edom or Philistia or Moab. Here it's the Valley of Vision. But look down in verse 8. The Lord Yahweh of hosts has a day of panic, subjugation, confusion in the Valley of Vision. In verse That was five. I said eight. That was five. Verse 8, he removed the defense of Judah. Verse 9, in the city of David. So, do you got an idea what the Valley of Vision is a reference to?
Israel.
From those, the Valley of Vision, defense of Judah, city of David. Probably Jerusalem. It is probably Jerusalem. Right? Let's read it. The Oracle Concerning the Valley of Vision. What is the matter with you now that you've all gone up to the housetops? Something's happening here. Now, what it is ain't exactly clear. You who were full of noise, you boisterous town, you exultant city, your slain were not slain with the sword, nor did they die in battle. All your rulers have fled together, have been captured without the bow. All of you were found, who were found were taken captive together, though they had fled far away. Therefore, I say, turn your eyes away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. The Lord Yahweh has of hosts. Has a day of panic, subjugation, confusion in the Valley of Vision, a breaking down of walls, a crying to the mountain. And Elam took up the quiver with chariots, infantry, horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. Then your choicest valleys were full of chariots, and horsemen took up fixed positions at the gate. And he removed the defense of Judah. In that day, you depended on the weapons of the house of the forest. And you saw that the breaches in the city of David were many. And you collected waters from the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem and tore down houses to fortify the wall. And you made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool. I'm going to stop right there for now. What do you see? What do you see when you see what you see?
Siege.
Siege. Okay. You see a city that, verse 2, was boisterous and exultant, but captured and carried off into captivity. And there.
That first part just seems they weren't paying attention.
You think? You think?
And that means they weren't listening to all these other prophecies.
You think? I mean, but Linda, really, really, is that unique to mankind not to listen to God? Mean, we got so much going on, and it's much more interesting than to be worried about what might happen out there in the future. And some ragtail prophet. Now we saw, where did we see that Jeremiah was to go naked and barefoot for 3 years, chapter 19. And this is what's going to happen to Egypt. You're going to listen to a guy that's running around naked and barefoot, like he's a spokesman for God. He doesn't have his collar on backwards. He doesn't even have his collar on. See? Right? And there's a lot of reasons people would ignore the prophets. And yet, that's what's going on. But look at verse 4. Therefore, I say, turn your eyes away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. What does that sound like to you? There's a book that was written 100 years later,
Lamentations.
Jeremiah's Lamentations of what actually did happen to Jerusalem. Here, Isaiah is predicting, here's what's coming. And Jeremiah, and so I just connect verse 4 with Jeremiah, the book of Lamentations, as Jeremiah weeps over what happened to a people who would not listen to God. And so he has a day of panic, of subjugation, of confusion. See, up there they had in verse 2, they had this noise exulting and all, but God has a day of panic instead in mind for this people. Chariots and Elam and Kerr. Who's Kerr? We've had it already. Back
And there were
15.
Medes and Persians.
Oh, that's
It's one of the key cities of Moab.
Oh,
Kerr
I
of
was going to
Moab.
say Ammonite, Ammon, or Moab.
Yeah, it's one of the key cities of Moab was Kerr. So surrounding nations, surrounding enemies, oiling the shield. Why do you oil a shield? Uncovering a shield. We had oil a shield earlier. Uncovering the shield. Take my weapons out of my closet, get my armor on, getting ready to go. I've uncovered my shield. Okay. And your valleys are full of chariots. The horsemen take up positions. Now watch verse 4. Yahweh removed the defense of Judah. In that day, you depended upon what?
Weapons.
What are the weapons of the house of the forest?
Isn't that one of the things that Solomon built?
Yeah, it was one of the three things that Solomon built. And the house of the forest, it was either the palace of the king or the home of the king. The palace would be where court would sit in judgment and the regalia of being king. And then the house, the one he lived in. And the third thing he built, of course, was the house of God, the temple.
Maybe the house of that's where the shields were.
So you depended upon the weapons that were used for the king's army. I think that's another way of saying it. Okay. You saw that the breaches in the city of David were many. What is that? The breaches in the city of David. What's that? What's a breach? Now,
That's
breaches
below.
are not breeches. They're different than breaches.
A
Below the
hole in the
breach of the
wall.
wall. Hole in the wall, a gap in the wall, an opening in the wall, whatever you want to say. You saw that a lot in indicating powerful sieges have been taking place. Their vulnerability, maybe you just let the wall collapse. And there are places that were, so you saw that there were many. and you collected waters from the lower pool. What's that all about? Collecting waters from the lower pool.
Know. So
They used to.
that's just storing it up for.
Storing it up. See, because one of the ways that a siege would be perpetrated would be cut off water supply to the city. But we've got plenty, see? And so you collected, then it says in 10, you counted the houses of, why count the houses in Jerusalem? You counted the houses in Jerusalem.
How much material?
How many of these can we spare? Here's how many people we have. Here's how many houses. We can tear down these houses. See, look what it says. You tore down houses to fortify the wall. You use the materials in the houses to build up your wall. You stored up water in the reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool, but you did not depend on him who made it. We got all this stuff. We can get our weapons out and we can fortify the wall and we can store up reservoirs. Why not just trust God? See, what did Israel, what did Jerusalem need to do? Come to Zion. Come to Zion. They needed to trust God too. Nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. And you can go all the way back to Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28 is generation after Leviticus 26, but it says basically the same thing. First 14 or 15 verses is a blessing if you keep my law, but the rest of the chapter is a curse if you don't, and itemize the curses. In Deuteronomy 28, he gets to the point where saying, you'll be so few in number and you'll be scattered among the nations.
What was the first quote, Leviticus? What?
Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are both about the blessings and the curses that God pronounced, but they're a generation apart. The one is when they're out Mount Sinai before they started their journey toward the Promised Land. The other is when they're in the plains of Moab just before they cross into the Promised Land a generation later. Okay, but and then in chapter 20, 32, beautiful, beautiful chapter, Deuteronomy 32. God sketching out his plan from the time that he began this nation to the time that he brought Christ in. It's just a sketch of God's purpose. And it indicated that his people would be judged and most of them destroyed. And so he says, you didn't take into consideration who planned it long ago. Now, the reason I went to Deuteronomy is because of the term long ago. Go back to the beginning of the nation. Where God knew what would the outcome of the nation be. Now, what's the first word of verse 12?
Therefore.
Therefore, okay, here's the situation. I'm crying over what's about to happen to my people. They're not taking it seriously. They think they can trust in their provisions for war, and they're not taking seriously the God who they're not depending upon him who made this or relying upon, considering that this was his plan from long ago. All right. So bad things are coming. Therefore, verse 22:11. Therefore, in that day, the Lord Yahweh of hosts called to weeping and wailing, to shaving the head and to wearing sackcloth. I'm going to pause there. Tell me what you see there.
Humility of the people before God.
Self-reflection.
Self-reflection. What did you say, Michael?
Humility of the people before God.
Yeah, right. The baldness.
It's almost all the way there. Self-reflection and humility. This is the opposite
Repentance.
of verse 11. They did not depend upon him. They didn't call out to, this is the full-bodied repentance that was necessary. Let me turn you over.
That's what I meant by self-reflection.
Yeah, okay. In the book of Joel, Hosea, Amos, Hosea, Joel, Amos. In Joel chapter 2, The locust invasion was a precursor or a forewarning of the Assyrian invasion. So Joel is quite a bit before Isaiah. Isaiah was right on the cusp of the Assyrian invasion. Joel was looking that it was coming. And he said in verse 12, yet even now, Joel 2, 12, yet even now, declares Yahweh, return to me with all your heart and with fasting and weeping and mourning, and rend your heart, not your garments. Now return to Yahweh your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and relenting of evil. Now, when you say God relents of evil, that doesn't mean sin. That means bad things. That means curse. I will relent of the curse or the damage that I'm intending to do if you repent. And so here he says in Isaiah 22, 12, therefore the day of Yahweh, that in that day the Lord Yahweh of hosts called for weeping and wailing. See Joel 2, rend your heart, not your garment, to the shaving of head and the wearing of sackcloth. And Joel 2 had that. See, mourning, all of those things that we just read. But what's the first word of verse 13?
Instead.
Instead. See, here's what God called for. Instead, here's what you did. Gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle, slaughtering of sheep. What's going on with that? Does God not want us to have a happy life?
They think they can buy their way out of it, maybe.
Or ignore their way out of it. Turn their back to it, pretend like nothing's wrong.
That's kind of sounds like
Slaying us, then might be for asking for
eating of
like
meat and drinking of
desperate.
wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. Live it up now.
Sounds like 22:2.
Pardon?
22:2. It's the boisterous city.
Yeah. A people that don't take God seriously, just live it. Nothing bad's going to happen. In the days of Jeremiah, which was just before this city fell, what were the prophets saying? It started with P. Peace, peace. There is no peace. The prophets were saying nothing bad's going to happen. That's what it meant. They meant by peace.
False
Not be at
prophets.
peace, but nothing bad's going to happen.
The false
And
prophets.
yeah, the prophet that Jeremiah was contending with, they called themselves prophets of Yahweh. So the people were ignoring the warning. They were ignoring the message. I called for repentance, and you went out and got drunk, had a party. You know what it reminds me of? Daniel 5, the day before the Babylonians fell to the Medo-Persians, the Babylonians were inside having a party and getting drunk and seeing handwriting on the wall and all of that stuff. Tomorrow you're going to die. But they were just, maybe it was just a party to forget, to numb their minds from what was about to happen. But God says, that's what my people are doing. Verse 14, no, verse, watch this interesting thing. In verse 13, he says, the people say, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. Paul quotes that or refers to that of the in 1 Corinthians 15, when he's talking about the resurrection, that people were just oblivious to him. Eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. In other words, don't pay attention to the consequence of your choices and where they'll take you. You're going to die anyway. You might as well have a good life right now. But, verse 14, Yahweh of hosts had revealed himself to me. Surely this iniquity shall not be forgiven you until you die. Eat and drink. Tomorrow we might die. And God says, well, you're not going to be forgiven until you do die. So exactly the thing you think is going to happen to you is going to happen to you, and you won't be forgiven.
Hey Ron,
Yeah, ma'am. Pick up.
could it be that, I mean, as another idea, that they said, let's eat and drink, and because tomorrow we may die, they didn't trust in God. They didn't even think to ask him for help. Could that be
Yeah.
it as well?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just,
And
but you know, I brought up Daniel 5 and the abandonment of the people to partying to numb themselves to the eventuality of tomorrow. It's going to happen to us tomorrow. And so we don't want to think about that. Let's just have a party. So I think you're right, but I think it's expanded beyond that. It's just the way humans deal with bad things that might be coming to them. We'll just, if we ignore them, we like the ostrich. You got the typical, stereotypical ostrich sticking his head in the sand, can't see what's coming. Let's just go have a big party and not worry about what's coming. And so I think all of that is involved here, this non-dependence upon God, but then
Self-centered.
wanting to, well, it's more than self-centered. I think it's wanting to not have to mentally grasp what's about to happen. And so just have a party so we don't have to think about the lion outside or the debt, the pile of debt that we have. Just party it away where it numbs the mind, keeps me from worrying about what's about to happen if I go out here and have a party. So at least that's at least a thing, a factor, a consideration to put into this.
Or they were like oblivious, kind of.
Yeah, that's a good word, oblivious. Well, I want to be oblivious to it. And how do I get there? I numb myself, give myself plenty of other things to think about. Yeah, Scott.
I'm trying to think of the phrase
What
that
phrase?
I'm thinking of. It's like cattle going to a slaughter. Let's go in and they'll hold up a little bucket of feed there
Yeah.
and whack.
All
But
right.
that's
One
they're like.
lemming fall over going in front. Yeah.
We could
Oh.
say that's how our society is, our
You think?
whole country and even
The
different countries.
Linda just put her finger on a truth. This is why God doesn't have to describe the United States of America, because people don't change.
Right.
We have everything we need to know about how nations work and how God works in nations in the history of Him doing it. And we'll either learn from those lessons or we won't. And that's why, Linda, that's why it's a remnant and not the vast majority. Our job is to make a difference to that one. Okay. You're still working for that, looking for that
Still looking
word.
for that phrase.
Well, I'm going to talk about a fellow named Shebna or Shebna, however you want to pronounce that. What's a steward?
Curious. Someone that takes care of another man's wealth.
Yeah, someone takes care of this, not strong enough, quite strong enough, someone who's in charge of. Yeah, so the Greek word is ru house ruler, oikonomia, the law of the house. Like Joseph was a steward. He ran everything for Potiphar, except his
Moses.
wife. Okay, so a steward. Now we're going to talk about a steward, the king's steward. So a man of great power at the time when there was this luxuriant, boisterous party making, we've got this guy. Now, the wolf's at the door. Assyria is coming, we know from chapter 8. But they're partying hardy, so they can just to ignore it. And Shebna apparently was typical, or perhaps heading up the ignoring, heading up the not paying attention to the prophet or the watchman, as it were. Thus says the Lord Yahweh of hosts, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the household. What right do you have here? And whom do you have here, that you have hewn a tomb for yourself here, you who hew a tomb on the height? You who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock. Told you to do that. And who gave you the permission to do that? What you doing is what God is saying to it. Behold, Yahweh is about to hurl you headlong, old man. He's about to grasp you firmly, roll you up tightly like a ball into a vast country. There you'll die. Okay, think about that. Think about that. I've got this great tomb, this monument of, to myself that I've just hewn, that I've just carved out of the rock. And God says, you know what? I'm going to throw you over far, far away, and you're going to die there. And then who's going to have your tomb? And there, he says, halfway through verse 18, and there your splendid chariots will be, you shame of your master's house. What good is his splendid chariot going to do him in the land of his captors? What good is the tomb he has there in Jerusalem going to do him as he's hauled off into captivity? You shame of your master's house. Then it will come about. So obviously, this steward is characterizing for me. Give me a profile of young steward.
He's
Go ahead.
self-important.
Self-important. I like that. Yeah. Self-aggrandizing. That's an even better term.
Look at my tomb.
Look at me. See the tomb, the great tomb?
His glorious chariots.
Oh, my glorious chariots. And that reminds me of Haman. Wasn't well, a chariot, it was a king's horse, but he was leading Mordecai around on the king's horse. Okay. I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. You know what, Linda, one of the things I take out of that is it doesn't matter how self-important I feel. I've got a God who's able to knock me down a peg or every peg, a peg or two or all the peg. He roll me up like a ball and throw me into wherever place he wants to. However important I might feel, I've got this God who has this kind of, not only this kind of ability, but this kind of sensibility. He's seeing what's going on. He's seeing the arrogance of this man. He's seeing what it's doing to the nation. You know, I look at some of the fraud that is being exposed in our governing system, the millions, if not billions, of taxpayer money that's being diverted to private individuals. Why? Because they can get away with it, because they are in the House of Representatives, or they are in the Senate. They have that kind of power. And so they can get away with siphoning off money that was intended for the homeless and the widows or the orphans and the needy. We'll just take it for and I think you see that this Shebna fella here, he's not the last person who ever took advantage of being in public power to aggrandize himself at the cost of others or without regard for what it costs others. And then I have this verse 19, I will depose you. And I think as long as God is still alive, the crooks and the wicked people don't have a chance. Oh, they'll flourish temporarily, but they don't have a chance. And it'll come about in that day, verse 20, that I'll summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. So you're wicked. I've got a servant. I'll summon him. And I will clothe him with your tunic, and I'll and tie your sash to clothe around him. I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. How in the world is this guy going to have all those kids? I will become a father. He will become a father. What does that mean? What does it mean to be fatherless?
The orphans.
Jesus said, I will not leave you orphans. I will come to you. I'll send the Holy Spirit. I will not leave you orphans. These are grown men. Okay? So it means more than just having a daddy, right? It means a protector, a provider, a guide, a leader. Joseph, it said, became a father to Pharaoh. We read in the book of Genesis, I think it's chapter 48. Joseph became a father to Pharaoh. Well, he wasn't his begetter, but he was provider, protector, guide. Okay, so,
Teacher.
pardon?
Teacher.
Teacher. Any of those things that the father would provide of guidance, protection, provision, sustenance, all of that. Okay?
That's the kind of steward God wanted.
Bingo! But we're not quite finished. That's exactly what we wanted, but keep watching.
You
Keep
ran
watching.
ahead.
Keep watching. So I will
Yes.
summon him. I'll clothe him with all of your stuff. He will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, the kingly house. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulders. What's a key represent?
Entry.
More than entry, authority,
Yeah,
permission. See? Entry is right, but I can enter because I can open things for others to enter. I don't have to enter myself. I can open it for you to enter. Watch. I will set on the key. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. Jesus used that of himself, didn't he? In the book of Revelation, chapters 1 and 2. And I will drive him a peg in a firm place. Now, what do you do with a peg in a firm place?
like a tent peg.
Well,
Pegs
it could be
do
a tent peg,
connect.
or it could be a wall peg, it could be a peg for hanging stuff on, like
Yeah.
pots and pans.
An anchor.
And
Somebody God can count on.
yeah, somebody that can be relied upon. I will drive him a peg in a firm place, and he'll become the throne of glory to his father's house. His father's house is going to say, there is my claim to fame, my son, see? The throne of glory to his father's house. So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels from bowls to all the jars. So he's going to be carrying the load for the house of Judah. In that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way, and it will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for Yahweh has spoken. So it kind of ends ingloriously, doesn't it? Any thoughts on that as we close out here? This great new steward entrusted by God with all this authority, he opening and closing authority and the glory of his father's house, and it's all hanging on him. And God drove him there, God put him there. And in that day, it's going to break off. In what day?
That day.
That day. That day that we've been talking about. That day when the invading hordes come through. Now, a thing that I take from this, and you can take from it more if you want, please do, that a corrupt steward is bound to bring a city down. And a steward who is righteous is far better. And the people will be far better off. But even a righteous leader is not the answer. Now, I think the United States has had some corrupt leaders and some good leaders, some who were in it for themselves and some who are in it for the country. And I'm not going to go through and name who I think those are because other people think it's the other way around. That's not the point. The point is, that's not the security of a nation to have a great leader. Now, I think it's important to vote, but I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference in the total outcome. You want to have security, there's one answer. Go to Zion. Go to Zion. Go ahead.
Even this good steward, the people, what would they would put their trust in that good steward instead of God?
Some would complain
I
that they didn't get their kickbacks.
and that's where you get a
Yeah.
it where they're going to break off and fall because they're
A
human.
yes, a and a good steward is not going to be able to sway the hearts of the corrupt people under his charge. And so it's not going to rescue the nation to have a good leader. That has to be people coming to Zion, one by one, individual by individual. Yeah, Linda?
God has a bigger, can have a bigger picture than, you know, even the leader at that time.
Well, he
you
can't.
A good leader.
But I don't, I think the point is, let's not put our confidence in voting the right man into office.
That's, take care of it.
That's, I mean, half the people in the United States think this is the right man, the other half thinks this is the right person.
But then some don't vote at all.
Well, that's not the point either. The point is, it doesn't matter how righteous and good, godly the leader is, it's not the answer to national security.
Yeah.
Zion is.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the point of what we're going to study chapter 3, the city of Tyre.
23,
city of Tyre. So the reading is still 13 through 23. Read all of that in next week. Any final thoughts? Okay.
Okay.
Pardon?
We can pray that.
We can always pray.
You know, some of our, I heard some people talking on X and .com, and I try to encourage them. We can pray that people like Elon Musk, for example, gets a little more with God. And
well, we should always pray for leaders, people, whether they're elected leaders or influencers. We should always pray for godliness in this nation. And that's a great idea, but the point here is, even if you have the most godly person leading the nation, that's not the answer. That peg is going to break. Even if he just dies of old age, that peg is going to break.